Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden, and joining me as tonight's co-host, an Emmy-nominated NBC legal and political commentator, Dean Johnson. Tonight, we begin a two-part series devoted to 2021, a year that began with the attack on the Capitol and racially inspired violence, and seems to be ending with brazen thefts by flash mobs infiltrating the holiday season.
Hi, Jeff, and welcome, everyone. This week, we want to start our closeout of the season by talking about what's going on and where do we stand in society, in the Bay Area, in the nation, and even globally. So tonight, our topics are going to include some or all of the following: the Great Resignation, violence on airplanes, conspiracy theorists, flash mob retail thefts, soaring homicide rates, random violence against ethnic minorities, school shootings, police shootings, and vigilante justice.
Just listening to the news has become a traumatic experience.
It certainly has. And tonight we're going to ask, what in the bleep is going on? Have the guardrails come off our society, and why? And what do we do about it? And we have a panel of terrific guests tonight. Two gentlemen who have spent their professional lives diving deep into these questions.
But tonight, more than ever, I want to extend my personal invitation for you to call in to briefly share your thoughts.
The so-called big brains are still trying to sort out all of these unprecedented phenomena that we hear about now every day.
But if you call in, maybe you can teach them a thing or two. What's going on with you, with your friends, with your family?
And why is this happening? Is it the pandemic? Is it inequality? Is it cultural acceleration? A bad example set by leadership? Government failure? A failure of the rule of law? Or just a perfect storm of many, many factors? Tonight, become part of the conversation. And you're our expert witnesses. You know what's going on. Let's hear what's going on in your homes and your neighborhoods.
And you do so by giving us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. There's much to discuss, and we've assembled just the right folks with whom to do it. But remember that just as a doctor can't diagnose you over the phone, our attorney guest can't provide you with legal advice about a particular case. We don't have all the facts, but they're here to help.
Our guests tonight are, first of all, Lawrence Douglas. Professor Douglas is the James J. Grossfeld Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College. Professor Douglas is the author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020, in which he described quite prophetically what would happen if Donald Trump lost the 2020 election.
And it's scary just how dead-on accurate that was. And Andy Barlow, Professor Barlow is a lecturer in sociology at UC Berkeley, where he teaches economic sociology, the sociology of race and ethnicity, and the sociology of law. Dr. Barlow is the author of numerous books and articles, including Between Fear and Hope, Globalization and the Politics of Race in the United States. Barlow is a civil rights activist who worked on California campaigns to defend affirmative action in 1996 and 2003. He was also lead plaintiff in Barlow v. Wilson, an effort to protect minority and women-owned businesses from discrimination. A former member of the board of directors of La Raza Central Legal in San Francisco for 10 years, Andy authors a blog on social justice entitled The Long View, Towards the Beloved Community. It can be found at justiceforall.law.blog.
And you know, both Andy and Lawrence spend their professional lives and have spent their professional lives thinking about these issues. So I think we just should let you two talk. And the big question tonight, what the heck is going on? Are things really as bad as they seem, or do we just perceive it that way because of the way the media presents it? Andy, Lawrence, whoever wants to go first.
Well, I'm happy to start off on a note of pessimism, because I do think things don't look particularly good right now. And, you know, the year started basically with this this act of violent lawlessness that we saw at the U.S. Capitol, these shocking images of insurrectionists at the behest of a president of the United States attacking a coordinate branch of government. And as shocking as those images were, I think at least some people hoped that that would be a snapback moment for American democracy, that it might have provided an opportunity for the Republican Party in particular to really realize that this unorthodox president was really nothing more than an autocrat who was willing to torch democracy in order to cling to power. And but instead of providing the snapback moment, what we've really seen over the months since the insurrection is the way that the Republican Party has actually worked within the law rather than engaging in more acts of lawlessness, the way they've worked within the law to try to operationalize the big lie that Trump lost the election as a result of fraud, and to turn state electoral laws into partisan mechanisms that will permit Republicans to control the outcome of a election in 2024. And so I really do think what we've seen is a further erosion of American democracy over the months of this year.
Yeah, I know there was a think tank in Europe that recently listed America for the first time as one of the backsliding democracies. And I take it you'd agree with that.
I would agree with that. I mean, it's a shocking thing. I don't think it's necessarily inevitable that that we're going to see 2024 as being the last, or we can look back at 2020 and look and say that that was the last Democratic election in our history. But I think without a lot of mobilization from the people and a lot of vigilance into what's going on around this country on the local level, I do worry not so much about the midterm elections in 2022, but about the presidential election in 2024. And I say that not because I necessarily think that Donald Trump is going to be running. I don't think it matters at this point. I think Trumpism has been successful enough in poisoning the waters of our electoral system that anyone who assumes the mantle of Trump, be that a Ted Cruz or a Josh Hawley, would be able to take advantage of these various schemes that Republicans have now put into place on the statewide level.
Andy, you've argued that the rule of law is under attack on multiple fronts. What do you mean by that, and why is this happening now?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, I completely agree with everything that's just said about the dangerous attacks on democracy that are happening. But at the same time, let's not lose sight of the amazing community organizing work and grassroots organizing work that has been going on in this country over the last decade in particular, but in some ways even longer. And this work has produced enormously important results, including Biden winning the White House, because the success of the Democrats in 2020 rested on the ability of organizations like the New Georgia Project and other organizations in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, and in other states that were swing states to be able to bring out enough minority votes to be able to counteract the project of the right, which is, of course, is a project of white nationalism. And the way in which the progressive movement has been able to successfully organize, however, has also required calling into question elements of the rule of law itself. And of course, what I'm referring to is the fact that the American legal system has rested very heavily on criminal prosecution and incarceration as a way of maintaining social order over the last 40 years. And the critique of that, which starts with Black Lives Matter or the work of Michelle Alexander and the new Jim Crow in 2010, and develops into a full-blown movement of enormous proportion in response to the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. These movements are themselves also very important because they are also calling into question very important elements of the rule of law, very important elements of the American social order, the retelling of American history that is happening, especially in the South now, with the coming down of Confederate statues, with the renaming of buildings, with the effort to really come to grips with the ways in which slavery and racism have actually been at the root of shaping the American experience, is a critique of the rule of law as well. And so I wanted to add that there's actually, to me, a very complex moment that we're in, where the question that I would love to be able to wrestle with a little bit is, how is the rule of law being beset in so many different directions at the same time? And of course, we're talking about the organized projects of progressives and the right, but what about the chaotic, unorganized things of people just bursting into stores and stealing everything they can and running out on the streets?
Yeah, I'd like to go even further on this question of the rule of law. I think Lawrence and Andy both, wouldn't you agree that what we saw on January 6th and the aftermath of the election was really not just a disintegration of the rule of law, but actually weaponizing the law itself through multiple lawsuits, through the use of the attempted use of the Electoral Count Act to overturn the election, and then the response after the election that we're seeing now to restrict voting rights. I mean, and isn't that one of the ways that democracies degenerate into authoritarian regimes, is simply by using law itself as a weapon against dissenters?
Yeah, I mean, on one level, you can say, just as a kind of, on a somewhat smaller level than perhaps the one that Andy was just describing, you could say that there was a certain degree of legal success that was responsible for challenging Trump's systematic attempt to insist that he had lost the election only as a result of fraud. I mean, one of the institutions that we can say actually was pretty responsible in its reaction to those to the big lie was the court system itself. I mean, we saw that Trump brought, I believe at the last count, it was 61 different suits in various states and municipalities, of which he lost 60 of them. And he lost suits in which he was arguing his case before judges of his own picking. So in a certain way, the courts did exert important resistance to the Trumpism. On the other hand, exactly as you point out, Dean, what we also see right now is the way in which is kind of the flip side of the way in which state legislators we've seen in 19 different states, state legislators passing laws that in many ways are designed to kind of undo the good grasswork organizing that Andy had just alluded to. They're trying desperately to strip, in particular, people of color of the right to vote. And that, of course, is, you know, that's not an example of lawlessness. That's an example of using law as an anti-democratic tool for the purposes of installing a regime of minority rule.
Yeah, and I would add to that that there's nothing new about that. That this is as American as apple pie, right? This is the story of Jim Crow. It's the story of slavery. And we are certainly seeing that law can be weaponized for the purposes of politics. I really appreciate Lawrence's calibration, though, because I think we really got to be careful here, is that we're not talking about the collapse of the rule of law. We're not talking about the end of law, that we're becoming a lawless society. We're talking about a society where the rule of law is being frayed and is being, and I love that you brought this into it, Dean, weaponized. And of course, at the most scariest level, it's being weaponized on the U.S. Supreme Court by Trump's appointees. And this is exactly what Sotomayor wrote in her dissent in the order to not hear the Texas abortion case, in the decision to not hear that. And what she wrote, what she warned against, was the weaponization of the law on the Supreme Court itself by Supreme Court justices. And that has terrifying implications, which we could explore, of course. But I would also point out that what it does is it destroys the most important bedrock of the rule of law, which is the claim that law is separate from politics.
Let me turn it over to Javier in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks. There's so many issues to discuss. I just want to focus on San Francisco and the lawlessness that appears to be increasing. Now, on a weekly basis, I can't tell you how many thieves that I interrupt, whether I go into Walgreens or Safeway. I actually went into McDonald's yesterday. What's happened is it seems like in San Francisco in particular, the laws are protecting the thieves, because we used to be able to interrupt people and prevent them from committing a crime. But nowadays, people pull out their phones and just start recording and nothing gets done. Safeway loses about 100 bottles every Friday night of alcohol. Nobody stops them. I'm pulling bags of alcohol and bags of shampoo out of the hands of these people who are stealing them, and the first thing they say is, "You can't touch me, I'll sue you." And people have actually gotten fired, employees at these stores, for trying to prevent these thieves from taking things. So this is what's really frustrating. And it feels like, if you look at Ohio, outside in Cleveland this week, there was someone who robbed an 80-year-old woman. He took her purse, and a bystander chased him down, tackled him to the ground, took the purse, and held him until police came. Why don't we bring that back? That's what we need. Society needs to protect each other. That's my comment.
Javier, before you go, I'd like you to stay with us. I'd like to have a little follow-up with you after I give our guests a chance to talk to you.
Sure.
But can I ask you, what's your position? Are you just somebody who happens to be shopping and sees this, or are you working in security?
I'm actually a contractor in San Francisco, and every evening when I get off work, I'm walking into these crimes. Bottles of shampoo stolen, alcohol bottles, or a drunk guy in McDonald's and nobody is looking at him. They just ignore him. People can step up and actually escort these people out of the store. You don't have to get physically violent. You just have to stop recording on your phone and tell them no.
So who would like to jump in? I mean, there's obviously something very profound going on. Andy, your hands up. Jump in.
Javier, I feel for you, dude, because, I mean, this is scary as hell. To witness what you've witnessed, to experience what you've experienced, and I think what many of us have seen, is really quite disturbing. What I worry about is, how do we fix it? Because we did try more cops and throwing people into prison, and we did it for 30 years. And we incarcerated more people than any other society in the world. We put one out of every 100 adults in the United States behind bars. And what we found out is it doesn't work. And in fact, in many ways, all it did was accelerate the problem. Because then when people came out of prison and were barred from getting jobs because they had a felony conviction or whatever, or what traumas they brought with them out of prison, there was even more disruption and more problems. And absolutely, this is an unsustainable situation we're in right now. The pandemic has accelerated everything. But I really want us to all think deeply about, in this moment, can we find a different way than returning to the rhetoric of more police and more prisons will make us safe? Because we know that we tried that. That was the war on drugs.
Maybe I would just add one thing to what Andy said, which is that, I do think that Javier's point underscores the way in which the unfortunate phrase of defunding the police just becomes a absolute non-starter for trying to create some kind of political consensus. That, as much as we might agree that there are all sorts of police practices that desperately need reforming, I don't know who came up with the term defunding the police, but it almost seems like something that right-wing trolls came up with for the purposes of discrediting any kind of progressive politics, because it just plays into the hands of those who want to insist that progressive politics is synonymous with a kind of chaotic anarchism.
You know, I'm really glad that Javier raised the issue of San Francisco, because it's one of my favorite subjects. What is actually going on there? And I should tell you, as background, I have relatives who live in red states and who are part of the Trump base. And San Francisco has become a trope for them. I mean, you see posts on social media all the time of, here's San Francisco. This is a perfect example of what happens when you have socialism. And when you have liberalism run wild. And my thought is that a lot of what's going on in San Francisco may be the product of the fact that it's the most capitalist city in America. Property values have gone through the roof. People who were middle class are now unable to afford, you know, a basic apartment and the basic necessities of life. And, you know, I'd love to hear everybody's thoughts on that. Javier, Andy, Lawrence, and Jeff, if you want to join in, what the heck is going on in San Francisco? And is it a microcosm for the future of America?
You know, one of the things that I had a long conversation today with a progressive attorney who pointed out that what we're seeing in some of these mob thefts is not a whole lot different than the type of organization we would see after a disaster or after protests or the like. We remember the riots in L.A., which is a number of years ago, where the day after the rioting, the day after the fires are out or the stores are broken or stuff, you have a wave of people protesting. You have others that may be doing some vandalism, predominantly because they're angry. But then you have a wave of people that opportunistically jump in and take advantage. Is that what we're seeing here? And before we go too far into this topic, Javier, next week on Your Legal Rights, we're continuing tonight's topic, and we want to focus more on what's happening with the thefts, what's happening with the civil disobedience, whether it's opportunistic or whether it's revolutionaries of some sort, or at least those that believe themselves to be, or maybe just people that are angry, or some combination of all of those things. So we will answer your question. We'll continue tonight, but I also want to let you know that tomorrow, or next week, our entire show is going to be based on that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
So in following up, do you have any feelings who these folks are, or do you think it's a mix of those things? Do you think that there's something more fundamental going on?
I have a couple of crazy theories. I think if you look at the targets of some of these flash mob thefts, they're the high-end designer stores. When they go into the more, if you will, middle-class stores like drugstores and stuff, they're taking the high-end cosmetics, anything that has a high, money-to-volume ratio. I think a lot of this is just on some subconscious social level a reaction to massive inequality and the fact that so many people get the consumer society through the media all the time, and everybody's life on media looks so good, and people become so alienated to that whole process that they just rebel and they say, you know, if everybody else has got this stuff, I'm going to have it too.
You know,
I think that the thing that I feel the most when I see the videos of people bursting into stores is their despair and their hopelessness. And I don't mean that they're poor or that they're being revolutionary by what they're doing. But what it is the same thing that all of us are feeling. This COVID has made many of us feel quite anxious and has brought out a feeling of frustration at the inability of our existing social leaders to be able to put the Humpty Dumpty back on the wall. It's just become a very difficult situation for more and more people to feel that there is a solution that is part of an organized response, something that they can trust. And I think in that setting, it was pretty inevitable that you were going to see people, in part for the reason that Dean said, just feel that there's nothing to lose and there is everything to gain from their disruptive behavior. And that let's be clear about it. What they're doing is certainly undermining a social order. It's undermining the rule of law. And I certainly don't think that they have some big revolutionary project in mind to recreate a society that is more just and fair. I think what they are doing is entirely a negative hit on the morale and the well-being of society. But I again go back to the question I asked Javier earlier, which is, it's one thing to believe that. It's another thing to say the solution is bring in an army of cops and they'll fix it for us. Put more people in prison and that'll stop it. It's not that simple.
You know, we had a caller call in. I did not put the call on air. The caller did not want to be heard, but did mention just now, 6 CVS stores just announced they were closing in different parts of the city. We have a Safeway that is closed in the evenings now for the first time in its history. It used to be 24/7. We've had several Walgreens that closed. And some of these are in commercial districts, but some of these are in underserved communities who are now going to have to travel farther, perhaps get in a car to go and fill a prescription, where people are suffering, and now they're going to suffer more. And what's the answer? I mean, the very people that are getting hurt are hurting their own community when they're really trying, in some cases, to just reconnect somehow.
I mean, the answer is to provide some type of massive new direction that people feel some confidence in will pull us out of this existing situation. I actually believe that the original Build Back Better Act, if it had been passed by Congress, would have given people hope and could have been the beginning of a very interesting process of reconstruction of the American dream and reconstruction of the American experiment. And the fact that it did not pass, the fact that it is very unlikely to pass, is something we might want to talk about as to the reasons for that. But certainly it seems to me that we don't have to look to some abstractions about socialism or about anything like that. There are efforts, very good faith efforts, that could be made right now that would provide enormously the type of leadership that would give people some hope and some confidence that they don't have now.
And maybe some of that message is rehabilitation for people that have been through the system, maybe had convictions, and maybe want to be able to reintegrate better in society.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one thing is, you know, I don't really know the demographics of the people who are participating in these flash mobs. So, you know, I don't exactly know if these are people with, you know, nothing to lose and everything to gain. I wonder if there are parallels to be drawn between people in these flash mobs and the insurrectionists who are attacking the Capitol in January 6th. I mean, one of the things we saw about the insurrectionists is that it was very interesting to see the demographics of the insurrectionists. You know, these are people who were not unemployed in the most part. These are people who had jobs. Actually, this Barton Gellman of The Atlantic kind of did a deep dive into the demographics of the insurrectionists and found some really interesting things. I mean, were these people who came from from districts that voted heavily for Trump? The answer is no. Were they, again, people who are unemployed? No. What he found over and over again was that these were people who came from districts, often blue districts, that had seen a rise in the non-white population. So again, it was kind of interesting the way in which these issues of race always become this, you know, the point at which American society splits on. So So
you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
In the world of songwriting and producing, it doesn't get much bigger than Jack Antonoff. He's worked with folks like Taylor Swift, Lorde, Lana Del Rey. I mean, that's just naming a few. You're going to hear Jack open up about a life-changing event he says made him who he is today. It's coming up on Q from PRX.
Yeah, Q from the CBC tonight at 7 o'clock, followed by One Way Possible with a music experience here on 91.7 FM KALW. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org. You are listening to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden. The time now is 6:31.
Great music for the next depression. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. In a year that began and ended with all the unprecedented challenges to our democracy, our economy, the very social fabric that holds us together, we're taking a look at the region, the country, the world, and asking, are the guardrails coming off? I'm Jeff Hayden, joined by tonight's co-host, NBC legal and political analyst Dean Johnson, and our guests tonight, Professors Andy Barlow and Lawrence Douglas. Who better to discuss such troubling developments? Why, that would be you, of course. If you have questions for my guests or wish to briefly share your own experiences, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. We're here to hear from you. Dean?
Yeah, you know, I was really interested in what Lawrence and Andy were saying before the break, and I had this kind of chilling picture in my head. I remembered back to Charlottesville and the demonstration there by the alt-right and the march with the torches, and I remember what the marchers were chanting: "We will not be replaced. We will not be replaced." And there have been people who've gone out and interviewed members of the so-called Trump base, and they asked them, you know, what drives you? Why do you support somebody like Donald Trump? And the most common answer is there's a fear of replacement, that somehow our culture is moving on and they're being left behind. And I wonder, is that what's really behind all of this? Is that what led to the insurrection? Is that what is leading to the various social disruptions? Do we as a society have a huge case of fear of missing out? Or is this just kind of a diplomatic way of saying that these people are worried about losing their white privilege?
I think a lot of it has to do, again, as I was suggesting right before the break, is I do think that that race plays an incredibly important role in explaining the popularity of Trump, and that you know, if you parse the meaning of this fear of replacement, this fear of losing the country, it's fear of basically losing a white majority status. And I think that, you know, fear of loss of status is an incredibly powerful tool in human behavior, a powerful motivator in human behavior, and explains a lot. You know, people can come along and say, well, isn't this bizarre the way in which, you know, middle or lower middle class white people can vote for tax breaks for billionaires? And the way they can identify with someone like a Trump, with whom they seem to have no material similarity whatsoever. But that also presupposes that politics is really about people who are going to support your material interests when I think the symbolic dimension is no less powerful. And Trump's ability to appeal to these people and to their feeling of grievance and to their fear of replacement, of being displaced and losing their white privilege and majority status, it's very real and it's very powerful.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, aren't we still, even in 2021, playing out the implications of the fact that this country started with an institution of slavery? There's a project called the 1619 Project that points out that slaves were actually imported into the United States before the Pilgrims even got here. And if you think about it, we would not have, if we had not had slavery as an institution, we would not have had the Civil War. We probably would not have had Abraham Lincoln. We wouldn't have had the post-Civil War amendments to the Constitution. We wouldn't have had the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and so on. It seems like we're almost still playing out the implications of something that happened almost 400 years ago.
But to that end, I think a lot of the people that are protesting, that are afraid of losing what others would consider white privilege, their privileged position in society, don't see themselves as privileged. They just see themselves as under threat. With that in mind, let me turn it to Daniel in San Francisco. Daniel, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm just listening just very briefly to what you guys had to say, and I just was strongly stirred by just what you just touched on, slavery, and how it's existed here in the United States. The country was founded on the premise of white supremacy, slavery, power. You might add Christianity on top of that. And this country is not a Christian country. They don't follow the principles of Christ. So which is love and compassion, and that seemed to go out the door. I mean, with Trump, blatantly, but under Obama and Bush and Clinton, I mean, the act of killing people in order to persevere as a country is automatically kind of excludes you from being Christian. So the stuff that's going on with the criminality around Oakland, I live in Oakland, I don't live in San Francisco, but I'm aware of the stuff that's going on in San Francisco and in Oakland and in the East Bay at large. It's people taking advantage. I mean, people are being criminals. That's it. It's not COVID. It happened before COVID. There was these flash mobs of criminality going on before COVID. I grew up in the inner city in Los Angeles, and the criminal mentality is criminal mentality. And it's not bad. There are, I think, circumstances that trigger it, definitely, because I grew up in the same boat. I mean, I have family members who were criminals, who are criminals. And it's just the way that you're brought up. And that's generational. It's not going to turn around with a new mayor or a new president, or it's generational. Parents, get involved. Brothers, sisters, get involved. Loved ones, get involved. Call out what is wrong. Learn what it is to love somebody and to do right and to change things around and to have compassion and to learn a story about drug addiction and mental illness. Those things are real. Those are the real things for sure. But there's also a lot of people jumping on that bandwagon who are getting away with a lot of criminality. So let's separate those things. And it hasn't been prosecuted the way it should. Do you want to lock people up for 99 years over selling a bag of weed? No, but there's definitely wrong is wrong and right is right. I mean, let's get back to that. There's a lot to unpack. I'm sorry, but that's just what I had to say.
Daniel, one question I have for you. You've Wait. Caught people. You've given them a sanction for what they've done. Do you believe that people should remain disenfranchised, or do you think that people should be able to recover so that you don't have this feeling in whole communities where people lack value.
The community itself is sick. It's not, I mean, disenfranchisement only happens. I mean, nobody's taking into account what is happening in their own communities, neighbor to neighbor. This is a community-based effort. You talk about grassroots. Don't rely on your council members to do it. Sometimes they don't even really, really live in your community, to be truth be told. It's neighbor to neighbor. It happens at school. It happens parents being involved. I'm talking kindergarten through high school and beyond. I know this sounds corny, but it's real. Okay? I mean, what happens in, I lived in Temescal, and now I live up near the Glenview, and people are involved up here. There's more of a police presence. There's more of a police presence in Temescal because the money's there, right? There's areas in San Francisco where the money's, there's things happening. It's hip. It's going on. So the cops are going to be there, right? It's like the policing. There's people getting, you can have a complaint and it'll be addressed. There's areas in West Oakland, East Oakland where this is, nobody's aware of this. I can't even believe that there's still gangs. There's still drive-by shootings. I'm 45 years old, and this stuff is still going on. I can't believe it. So people need to be involved. I mean, don't look for Mayor Breed or Libby Schaff to do something. Start looking at your neighbors. Go say something. And again, this sounds corny, but it's real. Somebody drops trash in your street. I mean, go call somebody out.
Hey, Daniel.
Daniel. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Hey, Daniel. Let me just tell you something very quick. You're obviously very impassioned about what you say, but I'm going to tell you something very quickly that I tell my red state relatives who are Trump supporters and also happen to be evangelical Christians. They tell me that, you know, the real solution here is we need a Christian republic. And I always point out that the United States is the among advanced industrial societies has more people that identify as Christians than any other country. We also have the highest incarceration rate and the highest rate of violent crime of any of those countries. The countries that have the lowest rate of violent crime, the highest rate of personal happiness, the highest rate of health care, and the longest life expectancies are all those countries where most of the people identify as either atheist or no religious preference. So I'm not sure Christ is the solution to this problem, but I don't know what is.
Daniel, I gotta let our guest answer your question. We have the phones are now lit up like a Christmas tree, so we really got to keep moving. But I do want to thank you for joining us in your legal rights. Also, you mentioned about not commenting on what's happening in San Francisco, but you live in Oakland. There's stuff there too. But in my limited knowledge of the media, the media is covering San Francisco and Oakland because that's where the media is. These things are happening throughout the Bay Area and, in fact, throughout the nation and the world right now. Before we move on to the next call, Andy, did you want to comment on some of Daniel's observations?
Yeah, I actually appreciate Daniel's emphasis on the importance of strengthening community. I couldn't agree more. And I do think that what I was talking about the positives of this year, came out of community organizing. And came out of the strengthening of community. I think the thing I would caution, though, is that strengthening community doesn't just happen neighbor to neighbor. It also requires people to have jobs and decent schools and access to housing and decent medical care. And there's more to it than just neighbor to neighbor. But there's no doubt about it. And I really agree with Daniel's point, including, and I'll push back, Dean, about something you were saying here, which is that it's true that Christianity has been weaponized by the right. But I think what Daniel was trying to say is that is not his understanding of the teachings of Christ. And that, in fact, there is another version of Christianity that comes mostly out of the Black Church that has been centered by the Reverend William Barber and the work of the National New People's campaign that is very powerful and a very helpful way of giving people access to the language of what it takes to strengthen community. So I just want to back up my brother there because I thought he was saying a lot of really righteous stuff.
Let me turn it over to Joseph in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, am I on?
You're on the air.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I speak as a multi-decade lawyer, frequently involved in these questions, and I have some significant police experience in an active city. I want to say this politely but bluntly. I've heard a lot of attorneys tonight who I don't think have much street experience giving very conceptual ideas of what explains the celebrated or infamous looting episodes that we've seen. The last caller was correct. These have been going on for a long time. However, in California, the voters, in their infinite wisdom, decided to strike a penal code section that made your second so-called shoplift conviction a felony. That and the reluctance or inability of district attorneys and politicians to actually take commercial burglary and theft cases seriously is an essential cause for the scope of the thefts and robberies, Estes robberies, that we're seeing. There may be multiple other causes. I'm not qualified to comment on them, but the lid came off with Prop 47 and some other changes in statewide law. And so if you put those laws back, and if you prosecute people, and if you put back the second conviction is a felony law, you will see a measurable, validatable change in these losses. We should be appalled, not just at the thefts, but you now have people working in drug stores and department stores who are afraid to go to work because they're getting struck by thieves who, by using force, become robbers. This is an extremely serious problem, and talking about vague political ideas isn't going to cut it. We have to make life tolerable also for people who shop and work in stores.
Joseph, thank you. Those are poignant observations, and I appreciate your joining us on Your Legal Rights. One thing you did say that needs addressing, you commented on Proposition 47 and how things such as a robbery, we refer to it as lawyers as an Estes robbery, were somehow affected. Estes robberies, any robbery still as of this date remains not only a felony, but a serious and violent felony that's a strike on someone's record. So I think you have that somewhat misused. I would agree with you to the extent that it made a second shoplift. That's the person stealing a second tuna sandwich from a store could have been charged with a felony. That's gone away. Now, any theft of $950 or more can still remain a felony, irrespective whether it's a first or a fourth, whether there's force used. So I don't disagree with some of your points, but I think you overstated it tremendously. But let me turn it to Roberta in Richmond. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. I feel that you stepped right over the anti-Semitism that was part of all of these things happening around the country. That's not the only part, but when they were saying they didn't want to be replaced, they specifically said, Jews will not replace us. And that should be pointed out.
Absolutely.
I can't take issue with that. It's very accurate.
Absolutely right. I don't think anybody disagrees with that.
Well, you did. You said it as if they were saying, we will not be replaced, and talked about what their mindset might be. I think it adds something to hear that they are specifically targeting a group to hate.
Oh, no question about it. Those groups were definitely anti-Semitic, and you're absolutely right at what they were chanting. I think our big concern is that those types of groups are using the fear of replacement as a means for recruiting people who, you know, may not be neo-fascist or may not be anti-Semitic as they are. And that's happening, and that's very dangerous.
You know, and it's happening all over Europe also.
Yeah, I, you know, one thing about the narrative, though, about Charlottesville just happens to be a community I know well. I've been doing research there for the last 4 years. I know quite well. I just want to point out that the response in Charlottesville to the alt-right attack was that the statue of Robert E. Lee, that was the flashpoint of the whole thing, has now been taken down. The city is in the process of a revisiting of its entire history of slavery. The University of Virginia has built a major monument to the people who built the university who were enslaved and has become a central part of the teaching of students at the university. The city has elected its first Black woman mayor in its history. There is a very, in the telling of our stories about the attack that took place, and it was a very important attack, we also have to look at the responses to the attack and understand that people are not just taking this sitting down. And the same thing with the overall narrative. Let's keep in mind the danger of the right-wing attacks on democracy, the right-wing racism, the right-wing
on voting.
And on voting, let's do that. But let's also look at the amazing work that's being done in this country to combat all that.
Don't blow it up too much, because people need to not be complacent about their participation.
Very much so.
And I think that's it. Bye.
And those are very important words, Roberta. Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Let me turn it to, we have two callers of the same name right now. Let me turn it to the caller on line two. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, yes, Jeff. I have a question I'd like to ask your guests to assess the current connection between the immigration crisis at the border and crime in California, if this is a myth or if this is reality. Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to, either one of you have a thought about that? You know, one of the things that I've noticed is that the places where the press has shown up and shown all the crime is nowhere near the border. I don't know if there's a connect there. Andy, do you have a feeling about that?
Well, I don't know what to say other than the fact that 99% of the people charged and convicted of crimes in the state of California are not undocumented migrants.
Yeah, and I've said many times on television that the statistics show that immigrants, whether documented or undocumented, have among the lowest rates of crime of any group in the United States. And if you really, really, really want your children to be safe from crime and you want to be crime-free, move to a neighborhood that has lots of immigrants.
Well, the other thing that we also saw during the Trump years in particular is we saw the way in which communities that had the greatest fear of crime being perpetrated by immigrants had very few immigrants in those communities. It really was basically responding to these boogeymen that were being circulated on right-wing media.
With that, let me turn it over to David in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, hi, David, number two. So very interesting. The prior program of that older prior attorney who did these calls, you know, was never political. It was always very, you know, legal oriented, and tonight's a little bit different. But I just wanted to bring it back to reality. I'm kind of agree with the attorney that called earlier on Prop 47 and putting it in perspective. My girlfriend works as a security guard at one of the big malls in San Francisco. And the stories I get is appalling and astonishing. You know, thieves come in, they throw things at the employees, and the police don't come, nothing is done. I myself have been a victim. I went to the police station. There was a line of three other people in front of me, all of whom their cars have been broken into. It's a pandemic of crime. Nothing is being done. And the criminals, they actually, in the case of the store, the shop, they come in laughing, and they do all sorts of crazy things. And the thing that really galls me the most, that hurts the most, is by not punishing crime, we're encouraging a generation. She told me a case recently. There were like, I think there was a 14 and a 15-year-old, and they brought an 11-year-old into the store, happened to be African-American, and they stole as much as they could fill up, and they went out laughing and then cursed at them and also threw stuff at them. This is what we're doing. We're encouraging, we're creating a whole new generation of criminals. That's what's going on. While you guys can talk about theory, this is the reality on the ground. And it's terrible. And we need to put back in, we have to have moderation. Let's not have Trump nutcases running around, but let's not have ultra-liberal wackos. We need moderation to bring San Francisco back to the nice city that it was.
David, thank you for joining us. And my only comment to you and to the last caller about Proposition 47 is that you've both been describing what is chargeable as a robbery. When you start throwing something at somebody or physically fighting them off or using resistance in order to leave with the goods, that's still chargeable as a serious and violent felony. That's not a question of Proposition 47. That's a question of whether local police and prosecutors want to really take action against those items. And that what we're seeing in the streets is not a result of Prop 47. It's a result of political will. It's a result of a lack of community. It's a whole lot of things we can say, but that proposition wasn't the root cause. And I'm sorry that we're essentially out of time, but I want to give Dr. Barlow, Dr. Douglas, each of you about a minute for any closing thoughts you had, knowing that we're going to resume this conversation next week. And I'm hoping you can both join us, but who would like to go first? About a minute to sum up anything you wanted to pass on.
Yeah, I think this has been a very difficult conversation, and I super appreciate all the call-ins because they really brought the proper energy to the conversation that's needed, which is people are really feeling a lot of worry, a lot of anger, a lot of despair at this moment. And I think a lot of those feelings are quite warranted. I'm just really asking everyone who's listening to have the courage not to try to go back in time to a time that is gone. San Francisco was a wonderful city when I moved to it in 1982, and I miss it terribly. I am fighting to keep Oakland a wonderful place to live now. But I absolutely understand that what we are up against, the forces we are up against, are not going to be resolved by more police and more prisons. What we're talking about is much deeper problems of hyper inequality, corporate profits running wild, unaccountable landlords, a healthcare system that does not serve the population. We have a lot to fix. And in order to do that, we can't go back and say, let's go back to what we were. Let's go forward and reconstruct this society and make it into what we want it to be.
Professor Douglas, we have less than a minute.
Yeah, I suppose maybe my parting thought would be, you know, the kind of fears that are being expressed right now and the kind of frustrations that are being expressed. I mean, I think one thing is we have to resist the temptation to look for simple solutions and to demonize individuals. I think that's something that, again, that the right wing has been very, very effective at kind of mobilizing and creating caricatures and simplifying social problems into, again, into these kind of pictures of people that we can blame for everything that's wrong with our society. And I think we kind of need to resist that impulse. And we need to recognize that these problems are very, very deep, very, very problematic. And one of the problems that we need to really kind of keep our eyes focused on, in addition to these deeper social problems, is just the threats to our political order that are kind of unfolding across this country. And I think if we're going to get any kind of ultimate control over the deeper social problems, we have to make sure that we still have a functioning democracy that can make that can shape policies that are going to be responsive to the concerns that we have. So I think my message is for us to remain extremely vigilant of the kind of attacks and threats to our democracy that are being engineered.
I hate to cut you off. We are out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Our guests have been Professor Lawrence Douglas and Professor Andy Barlow. Tonight's show was produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly. Next week, we continue this conversation in part two of the same conversation. My thanks to my co-host, Dean Johnson, and to our guests for joining us, and to you for listening to us tonight. And at the controls, back for a limited engagement, D Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and have a good night.
And you're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, online at KALW.org.